has his or her views before she adds her own. Multipliers create safety, but they also maintain pressure for a reality-based, rigorous debate. Multipliers make sure everyone is wearing a seatbelt because they are about to put their foot on the accelerator. The Yang. Demand rigor. How do multipliers demand rigor? They ask the questions that challenge conventional thinking. They ask the questions that unearth the assumptions that are holding the organization back. They ask the questions that cause the team to dig harder and to think deeper. They ask for evidence. They aren't overly swayed by opinion and emotional arguments. They continue to ask for evidence that would confirm a point of view. And they ask for evidence that might suggest an alternative point of view. They pursue all sides of the issue. When the group moves too quickly toward agreement, multipliers often step back and ask someone to argue the other point of view. Or they might make the argument themselves. They make sure all the rocks are turned over. When the senior management team of a European online distribution company met to discuss whether to add a new feature to their online store, there was strong support for the idea among the team. But the CEO wasn't satisfied with intuition and wanted to drive more rigor into their collective thinking. He asked the senior executive team whether the new feature would actually drive higher sales. At first, there were opinions, but the CEO wanted data and wanted to know what the facts proved. The executive team began to dig into the facts in a summary analysis. Again, the CEO dug deeper. He asked the group to go country by country, poring over the data to look for an answer to the questions. As one executive who was present said, "Nobody got away with their own opinions." The group wrestled with the issue until they finally concluded that they didn't have enough information yet to make a clear decision, and they identified what additional data they needed. This company's leader kept the debate going by demanding rigor and sound decision-making. According to one of his management team members, Jim Barksdale, former CEO of Netscape, was well known for saying, "If you don't have any facts, we'll just use my opinion." Sue Siegel, as president of Affymetrics, led the company through a moment of truth decision in 2001 by using the power of facts and openness to harness the full brain power of the organization. Affymetrics produced microarray technologies that allow scientists to analyze complex genetic information. The company had been public for 3 years and had grown steadily to 800 employees. Sue received some troubling news from customers that there were some problems with the gene chip microarrays that could potentially render inaccurate results, but only for a minor portion of its applications. As president, she would have to make one of the toughest decisions that the company would face in the next several years. Should they recall the product? Sue was herself a veteran executive of the life sciences industry and had deep knowledge of the underlying technology and issues. But instead of relying solely on her own understanding of the situation, she went beyond the management hierarchy and reached deep into the organization for data and for insight. She went straight to the people who understood the issues and let them know she needed their input. She then convened a larger forum of several layers and management. She framed the magnitude of the issue and the potential impact to the company. She laid out a couple scenarios and then began asking questions. She ensured that the group thought through the decision from every angle. What is the impact on our customers? What is our legal obligation? What is the financial impact? Sue asked for data and their recommendations. The group then debated for 2 arduous days. After several debates, she asked the management team to weigh in, and then they made the decision to recall the product. The next day, Sue boarded a plane to present at the Goldman Sachs Financial Conference in Laguna Niguel, attended by over 1,000 analysts, shareholders, and industry experts, to tell them about their mistake and their decision. The product recall was a financial setback for the young organization, adversely impacting market cap for 2 quarters and sending it from Wall Street darling to leper overnight. However, with the company's staff behind the decision, they were able to execute the decision with conviction and explain it to their customers and to the market. This allowed them to rebound quickly to regain their market position and exceed their market cap. In fact, the product recall became a turning point in building deep customer relationships and respect for employee input that would become the hallmark of the company. In the 4 years that Sue led the company following the product recall, Affymetrix continued to grow sales and beat expectations for both revenue and earnings. Sue Siegel led this organization successfully through one of its toughest decisions because instead of turning inward, she reached out and utilized the full intelligence of the organization to make a decision that was grounded in full disclosure and fact and in the best interest of their customers. The following summarizes some of the practices debate makers use to create safety while also demanding rigor. Create safety for best thinking, the yin. Share their view last after hearing other people's views. Encourage others to take an opposing stand. Encourage all points of view. Focus on the facts. Depersonalize the issues and keep it unemotional. Look beyond organizational hierarchy and job titles. Demand rigor, the yang. Ask the hard questions. Challenge the underlying assumptions. Look for evidence in the data. Attack the issues, not the people. Ask why repeatedly until the root cause is unearthed. Equally debate both sides of the issue. 3. Drive a sound decision. Multipliers may relish a great debate, but they pursue debate with a clear end, a sound decision. They ensure this in 3 ways. First, they re-clarify the decision-making process. Second, they make the decision or explicitly delegate it to someone else to decide. And third, they communicate the decision and the rationale behind it. Reclarify the decision-making process. After the issue has been debated, multipliers let people know the next step in the decision-making process. They summarize the key ideas and outcomes of the debate, and they let people know what to expect next. They address such questions as, are we making the decision right now, or do we need more information? Is this a team decision, or will the leader make the final call? If it is a team decision, how will we resolve any differing views? Has anything that has surfaced in the debate altered the decision-making process? One executive we studied was strong on closure. Allison says who is going to make the decision and when. People aren't left in limbo wondering how the decision will be made. Multipliers let people know what will be done with their thinking and their work. With this sense of closure, people around them are assured that their discretionary effort won't be wasted, and they are likely to give 100% the next time. In this way, multipliers get full contribution not just once, but over and over again. Make the decision. Although multipliers know how to generate and leverage collective thinking, they are not necessarily consensus-oriented leaders. At times, they may seek the full consensus of the group. However, our research shows that they are equally comfortable making the final decision. One manager responsible for emerging markets within a global technology firm said of her leader, "Chris prefers collective decisions and consensus, but he's practical and he'll either make the final decision for speed or defer to someone else because it is clearly within that person's domain." Communicate the decision and rationale. One of the benefits of purposeful, rigorous debate is the business case and momentum it builds to execute the decision. As people debate an issue thoroughly, they develop a deep understanding of the underlying problems and opportunities and the imperatives for change. They put their fingerprint on the decision. Because they achieved a collective understanding, they are capable of executing collectively. Lutz often held his organization's debates in a conference room they came to call the theater. The theater looked like any other conference room, with a large conference table that the key players sat at during the debates. However, the room had twice as many chairs set up around the perimeter of the room. These debates were open to anyone in the organization. Anyone interested in the issue could come and listen. The team called it the theater because it was like a surgical theater in a teaching hospital. As people watched these debates, they came to a better understanding of the issues. When decisions were reached, there were people at all levels of the organization ready to execute. With this model of transparent decision-making, communicating the decision and the rationale is easy because the organization is already prepared to move forward. The theater not only helped employees in this organization understand and prepare to execute the decision at hand, they were also learning what was expected of them when they were called to the table to a debate on another issue. They were like medical students learning to perform surgery. The diminisher's approach to debate. Instead of looking out broadly into their organization for intelligence, diminishers tend to make decisions quickly, either based solely on their own opinions or with input from a close inner circle. Then people begin to spin and speculate and get distracted from enthusiastically carrying the decisions out. In sharp contrast to the theater of the executive above, one diminisher I worked with held meetings in his office in a two-circle format. Seated at a small round table was his equally small inner circle, who would discuss the issue and make the decisions. But around the perimeter of the room was a collection of silent people, standing and taking notes. After participating in this strange meeting format, I couldn't help but ask one of these voiceless individuals standing on the outer edge about the role of this silent body. She said, "Oh, we don't ever participate in these decisions, and we certainly don't get a seat at the table. We're just here to take notes so our SVP doesn't have to tell us what to do later." This was less of a surgical theater and more of a lecture auditorium. Instead of framing issues for debate and decisions, diminishers tend to raise issues abruptly, then dominate the discussion before forcing a decision. Raise issues. When a problem surfaces, diminishers bring issues or decisions to people's attention, but they don't necessarily frame them in a way that allows others to easily contribute. When they raise the issue, they focus on the what rather than the how or the why of a decision. One CIO routinely raised a variety of distracting issues at his weekly staff meetings. One of his directors explained, "Once he came in and raised the issue of ergonomically sound keyboards, and then went on about them for an hour. He is intense and intelligent, but all over the place. He makes a millimeter of progress in a million directions." Dominate the discussion. When issues get discussed or debated, diminishers tend to dominate the discussion with their own ideas. They are debaters, not debate makers. Looking back at Jonathan Akers, where did he fall short? He gathered the right players and he gathered the data, but he never sparked a debate. Instead, he dominated the discussions with his opinions and shut down the intelligence and drive of the players he had assembled. Force the decision. Rather than driving a sound decision, diminishers tend to force a decision. They force the decision either by relying heavily on their own opinion or by shortcutting a rigorous debate. As one executive said in an attempt to drive closure after dominating the discussion during a task force meeting, "I think we're all in agreement that we should centralize this function on a global level." The group looked bewildered, knowing that this was not the shared opinion of the group. One brave woman broke the silence and responded with, "No, Joe, we have heard your opinion, but we don't have agreement." What is the impact to the organization of the diminisher's approach to decision-making? At first glance, it appears that diminishers make efficient decisions. However, because their approach only utilizes the intelligence of a small number of people and ignores the rigor of debate, the broader organization is left in the dark, not understanding the decision nor the assumptions and facts upon which it is based. With this lack of clarity, people turn to debating the soundness of a decision rather than executing it. This spin phenomenon is one of the reasons diminishers create resource drain rather than resource leverage. Debate making as resource leverage. Multipliers don't act as debate makers because it makes people feel good. Multipliers operate as debate makers because they want to leverage every ounce of intelligence and capability they can in making and executing sound decisions. The following information reflects why decision makers leave capability on the table while debate makers leverage and stretch the capability of their resources. Decision makers, what they do. engage a select inner circle in the decision-making process, underutilization of the bulk of their resources while a select few are overworked. Decision-makers, what they get. A lack of information from those closest to the action, resulting in poorer decisions. Too many resources thrown at those who don't have the understanding they need to execute the decisions effectively. Debate makers, what they do. Access a wide spectrum of thinking in a rigorous debate before making decisions. Debate makers, what they get. High utilization of the bulk of their resources. Real information they need to make sound decisions. Efficient execution with lower resource levels because they have built a deep understanding of the issues, which readies the organization to execute. In summary, decision makers don't use the full complement of talent, intelligence, and information that is available to them. This capacity sits idle in their organization. To counteract this, they continue to ask the organization for more resources, wondering why they aren't more productive. In contrast to this, multipliers not only engage the best thinking of the resources around them, they use debate to stretch the thinking of the individuals and the team. While decisions are debated vigorously, real facts and issues surface, forcing people to listen and learn. As a result, multipliers get full capability out of their current resources, and they stretch and increase the capacity of the organization to take on the next challenge. This begs a question. How does someone learn to lead debate like Lutz at Microsoft Learning or Sue Siegel at Affymetrics? How does someone go from being a decision maker to a debate maker? Becoming a debate maker. Our research and experience coaching executives reveals that leaders can move along the diminisher-multiplier continuum, but it requires more than just adding some new leadership practices. It often requires a fundamental shift in the assumptions of the leader. Often, this shift happens when a leader begins to view his or her role differently. It can happen when leaders see that their greatest contribution lies in asking the questions that produce the most rigorous thinking and answers. Several years ago, I volunteered to be a discussion leader for a junior Great Books program at an elementary school. It seemed like a simple volunteer job. The assignment was straightforward: lead a discussion of a group of third-grade students on a piece of great youth literature. The goal was clear: have them dig deep into the story for meaning and debate it with their peers. Despite my protests that I knew how to facilitate discussion, I was sent to a one-day training workshop to learn a technique called shared inquiry. What I found was a simple but powerful technique for leading debate. There are three rules to shared inquiry. 1. The discussion leader only asks questions. This means that the leader isn't allowed to answer his or her questions or give his or her interpretation of the story's meaning. This keeps the students from relying on the leader's answers. 2. The students must supply evidence to support their theories. If the student thinks that Jack went up the beanstalk a third time to prove his invincibility, he or she is required to identify a passage, or more than one, in the text that supports this idea. 3. Everyone participates. The role of the leader is to make sure everyone gets airtime during the discussion. Often, the leader needs to restrain stronger voices and proactively call on the more timid voices. As a discussion leader, it was liberating to ask the questions but not give the answers. In fact, I found it strangely powerful. And when the students spouted off their views and interpretations of the story, it was thrilling to look them straight in the eye and say, "Do you have any evidence to support that claim?" Initially, they looked terrified, but they quickly learned that the cost of an opinion was evidence. As they gained experience, they learned to respond quickly. They would assert an opinion, and then I would insist, with my best intimidating look, "Show me your evidence." They would scurry to locate the exact place in the text that supported their claim and cite it with conviction. And because everyone was called on, every student learned to state their views and support their ideas with data. This experience cemented my belief that there is a process and a formula for great debate. The starting block. We've gone through a master approach to how multipliers create debate, but here is a simplified three-step process to get started. 1. Ask the hard question. Ask the question that will get at the core of the issue and the decision. Ask the question that will confront underlying assumptions. Pose the question to your team and then stop. Instead of following up with your views, hold yours and ask for theirs. 2. Ask for the data. When someone offers an opinion, don't let it rest on anecdote. Ask for the evidence. Look for more than one data point. Ask them to identify a cluster of data or a trend. Make it a norm so people come into debates armed with the data, an entire box if necessary. 3. Ask each person. Reach beyond the dominant voices to gather in and hear all views and all data. You might find that the softer voices belong to the analytical minds, who are often most familiar with and objective about the data. As you rethink your role as a leader, you will come to see that your greatest contribution might depend on your ability to ask the right question, not have the right answer. You will see that all great thinking starts with a provocative question and a rich debate, whether it is in the mind of one person or an entire community. Discussion, dissent, and debate. Hubert H. Humphrey, America's Vice President under Lyndon B. Johnson, captured the essential principle of how multipliers make decisions when he said, "Freedom is hammered out on the anvil of discussion, dissent, and debate. Our research showed that it is this discussion, dissent, and debate that also hammers out sound decisions. Intelligence multipliers know how to create this debate to generate strong support for high-stakes decisions while also building the collective muscle of the organization to deliver on promised results." Chapter 5 Summary: The Multiplier Formula. The Decision Maker versus the Debate Maker. Decision makers decide efficiently with a small inner circle, but they leave the broader organization in the dark to debate the soundness of the decision instead of executing it. Debate makers engage people in debating the issues up front, which leads to sound decisions that people understand and can execute efficiently. The three practices of the debate maker. 1. Frame the issue. Define the question. Form the team. Assemble the data. Frame the decision. 2. Spark the debate. Create safety for best thinking. Demand rigor. 3. Drive a sound decision. Re-clarify the decision-making process. Make the decision. Communicate the decision and rationale. Becoming a debate maker. 1. Ask the hard question. 2. Ask for the data. 3. Ask each person. Unexpected findings. 1. As a leader, you can have a very strong opinion, but also facilitate debate that creates room for other people's views. Data is the key. 2. Debate makers are equally comfortable being the decision maker in the end. They are not only consensus-driven leaders. 3. Rigorous debate doesn't break down a team. It builds them and makes the team stronger.
Chapter 6. The Investor. If you want to build a ship, don't drum up the men to gather wood, divide the work, and give orders. Instead, teach them to yearn for the vast and endless sea. Antoine de Saint-Exupéry.
It is after midnight at the McKinsey office in Seoul, South Korea. The lights are out, except in one conference room occupied by a project team that is 2 days away from a critical presentation to one of the firm's biggest clients in Asia. The team is led by Hyun Ji, a sharp, highly regarded project leader. Joining them this night is Jay Choi, one of McKinsey's Seoul-based partners. Jay knows the team has a critical deadline and, as is typical, is meeting with the team to guide, challenge, and shape the thinking as they build the first major presentation of their findings to the client. The project leader, Hyun-ji, is at the whiteboard. She and the team are retesting the storyline with some new facts that surfaced during the past week. The team is struggling to integrate the findings into the overarching message about the client's business transformation. Jay listens carefully and asks a lot of questions, as he is known to do. It becomes clear that the team is stuck. The team leader is systematically working this tough problem, but looks at Jay with that desperate look that signals, "I could use a little help here." Jay has been on countless numbers of these projects and has stood in the project leader's shoes many times. He can see a storyline that the team, who has been buried in the details, has not yet considered. Jay offers a few thoughts for the team to discuss, standing up to take the whiteboard marker from the team leader. Heading to the board, he begins to list several emerging themes, encouraging the team to view the facts from a different angle. The group is thrilled to have this fresh perspective, and excited voices are now engaged in testing, pushing, and building on the ideas, despite the late hour. With the new insights coming from the renewed discussions, Jay can now visualize the new presentation flow in his mind. He feels a familiar comfort up at the whiteboard. The desire to drive the team toward completion is alluring. He is tempted to lay it all out for the team so they can all go home and get some rest. The consultant in Jay tells him to go on and finish the job and complete the storyline himself. But the leader in Jay signals restraint. He stops sketching and turns to the project leader, checking to see if she is comfortable with the new direction. Seeing the smile on her face, Jay says, "Okay, looks like we've got a new line of thinking to run with. Let's see what you can do with this." He then hands the pen back to Hyun-ji, who resumes command of the process and leads the team to build an outstanding presentation for the client. Surely it was tempting for Jay to jump in, rescue the struggling team, and drive the presentation to completion himself. He would have felt like a hero, and probably a few years younger, too. And it was appealing for the team to let him do it, given the late hour. But Jay's proclivity to invest in people and their development won out. Jay reflected on the leader's role. You can jump in and teach and coach, but then you have to give the pen back. When you give that pen back, your people know they are still in charge. When something is off the rails, do you take over or do you invest? When you take the pen to add your ideas, do you give it back or does it stay in your pocket? Multipliers invest in the success of others. They may jump in to teach and share their ideas, but they always return to accountability. When leaders fail to return ownership, they create dependent organizations. This is the way of the diminisher. They jump in, save the day, and drive results through their personal involvement. When leaders return the pen, they cement the accountability for action where it should be. This creates organizations that are free from the nagging need of the leader's rescue. Multipliers enable others to operate independently by giving other people ownership for results and investing in their success. Multipliers can't always be present to perform emergency rescues, so they ensure people on their teams are self-sufficient and can operate without their direct presence. Thus far, the book has explored why multipliers make people smarter and more capable in their presence. But now I ask you to consider a different question. What happens when the multiplier isn't there? What happens to people when the sunlight of the multiplier isn't shining in their part of the world? This chapter addresses this most curious question. Can multipliers create an organization that can act intelligently and deliver results without their direct involvement? The micromanager versus the investor. Multipliers operate as investors. They invest by infusing others with the resources and ownership they need to produce results independent of the leader. It isn't just benevolence. They invest and they expect results. Forever strong. Larry Gelwick stood on the side of the rugby pitch, watching his high school team practice. He thought back to the first team he had coached to the national championships. He remembered them being up before dawn, training together. Larry said under his breath, "Well, that was then." The team in front of him was good, to be sure. They were learning the game, but he noticed they didn't have the physical stamina of previous teams. Larry felt stuck. It wasn't like he hadn't tried. He reminded them at practice all the time. They would nod their heads, but then they didn't do it. He could cancel practices and hold fitness training in its place, but that risked the skill level of the team. He could yell at them, but that would only work for a day or two. Larry leaned over to an associate coach and said, "We need to turn this over to the captains." The next day, Larry stood up, walked quickly to the chalkboard, and drew a line from one side of the board to the other. He said, "We have 6 weeks left until the finals, and it takes a pretty good athlete 6 or 7 weeks to build the endurance he needs." The coaches and captains were listening to every word. He continued, "If we figure this out now, we can win the nationals. If we can't, we'll be running on empty." Larry said, "There are two options. The coaches can keep trying to figure something out, or you as the captains can take ownership for finding a solution. What should we do?" There was a pause. Then the captain of the back said, "We'll take it on." Larry said, "Right now, I own this challenge. Once you take it on, you'll own it completely. We'll expect an update from you 2 weeks from today, but we won't bug the team at all." There was a silent agreement as the captains looked at each other, and the captain of the forwards stood up and went to the board. He turned to Larry, who had sat down with the other coaches, and said, "Okay, we have a few questions." Larry and the coaches stayed and answered questions about what types of fitness training produced speed, agility, and endurance, until eventually the coaches were excused and the four captains, all in their teens, stood in a semicircle around the chalkboard figuring it out. The solution they implemented was to divide the team into small groups of 4 to 6 people, each with its own leader. The captains would keep the subgroup leaders accountable, and the leaders would keep the players accountable. The smaller groups met before or after school for fitness training for weeks, and the team soon became one of the fittest in the 34 years Larry has coached the team. They went undefeated all season and won the national championship. How would a micromanaging coach have approached the same problem? We don't need to wonder. Calling every play. Marcus Dolan shouted across the school at John Kimball, "Get over here!" Marcus was a musclehead coach who wanted to micromanage every aspect of his team. He yelled at one of his team captains, "Don't ever hold a practice without me or you'll be off this team. You've probably already messed everyone up." Not surprisingly, John didn't try again. He and the other players slowly stopped taking initiative entirely. Playing for Marcus meant you did what he said without question. The endless laps at practice just had to be done. Even in the games, he called every play for every player. The team was so focused and dependent on Marcus, they couldn't think intelligently or adapt rapidly to the changes on the field. They lost every game. Marcus took a group of players that had begun with a sense of ownership for the team and micromanaged it out of them. Interestingly, Marcus Dolan was later elected the most losing coach in high school sports history by Sports Illustrated. More interesting still, 8 of his players eventually left the team and went to play for Larry Gelwicks. In fact, they were on the team described earlier that woke before dawn to practice. They were the team that led Highland to its first national championship. Running onto the field. Why is it that when the stakes are high, so many managers jump in and take over? I've watched hundreds of youth soccer games, and I have to admit that I find myself watching the coaches more than the players. This is one of the curses of genius watching. I've seen a lot of very frustrated coaches during those games when the team is down and playing horribly. I've seen crazy arm waving, copious shouting, and an occasional tantrum on the sideline. But I've never once seen a coach run out onto the field, steal the ball away from a player, drive down the field, and score. It has just never happened. Yet each one of these coaches had the skills required to score the game-winning goal, and I'm sure a few have been tempted to. So why didn't they? Beyond the obvious reason that it is against the rules, it simply isn't their role. Their job is to coach, and their player's job is to play. What perhaps isn't so obvious is why, when the stakes are high, so many managers and organizations don't hesitate to run onto the playing field, steal away the ball, and score the winning goal. Managers jump in because it isn't illegal, and many can't resist the lure to do so. A sales manager who doesn't see fast enough progress in an important prospective client jumps into the sales process, trying to win the deal himself. A marketing vice president watches one of her people stumble as he presents the new product go-to-market plan to the CEO, who begins firing tough questions at him. The marketing VP, fearing the CEO will lose confidence in her staff, jumps in and not only answers the tough questions, but finishes the presentation. You might ask yourself, how would I coach if I could never step out on the playing field? How would I lead if I couldn't jump in and take over? How would I respond to a performance gap if I were a multiplier? Multipliers understand that their role is to invest, to teach, and to coach, and they keep the accountability for the play with the players. By doing so, they create organizations that can win without them on the field. Let's now explore the discipline of the investor and how multipliers create organizations that can perform and win not only without them on the field, but long after their direct influence is felt. The investor. Ela Bhatt, or Elaben, is a slight 78-year-old Indian woman who is soft-spoken to the point of seeming almost fragile. She lives in the simplest two-bedroom bungalow where her bed doubles as a desk chair. She grew up listening to her teacher speak of India's struggle for independence, and her parents tell stories of her grandfather joining the 24-day salt march from Mohandas K. Gandhi's ashram in Ahmedabad to the Arabian Sea to make salt in symbolic defiance of British law. In order to gain first-hand experience with rural poverty, Elaben went to live in the villages of India and saw for herself that the political independence gained from British rule was not enough. Economic independence would be the next victory. In the villages, she saw both the vibrancy and the struggle of the self-employed seamstresses, street vendors, and construction workers, and, in response, founded the Self-Employed Women's Organization, SEWA, in 1972, which gradually became a significant union in this region. It would have been easy for Elaben to be elected General Secretary of SEWA every 3 years, as dictated by law, forever. In this way, she could have owned the organization's agenda indefinitely and just assigned tasks to everyone else. SEWA, after all, was her creation. It had evolved slowly in her mind, and it would have been understandable, if not expected, for her to remain its formal leader in perpetuity. Yet Elaben insisted on turning over the responsibility for running SEWA to new and younger leadership. She personally invested the time and energy into educating members about the democratic process and encouraged everyone to gain the political literacy needed to step up and run for one of the open positions. In a fascinating embodiment of SEWA's mission and management philosophy, Jyoti Makwan, who enrolled as a member of SEWA as a poor Gujarati-speaking cigarette-rolling worker, went on to become the English-speaking General Secretary for SEWA. In this role, she has led the union, which at the most recent election involved 1.2 million people. Jyoti could have spent her work years figuring out how to survive from day to day, but because of Elaben's leadership, she has used her intellect solving complex problems that reach across international boundaries and affect more than 1 million women like herself. She recently stood shoulder to shoulder with Elaben and U.S. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton as they answered questions at a press conference. Jyoti's story is just the beginning. If you look at the second generation of chief executives of all the SEWA organizations, they all first worked under Elaben's tutelage. Each was given greater and greater ownership as they matured into capable managers. Every time Elaben established an institution, she invested in the future leaders, which allowed her to step away from the operational management. The succession was handled so gracefully that she could leave with the confidence that her presence would still be felt as she is elsewhere investing her energy in establishing another institution. The SEWA union was followed by a bank, created from 4,000 women each depositing 10 rupees, and this has been followed by the Gujarat Mahila Housing SEWA Trust, the Gujarat State Mahila SEWA Cooperative Federation, SEWA Insurance, SEWA Academy, HomeNet South Asia, and many others. Elaben continues to invest in building leaders and organizations that can operate independently of her. Her influence is like that of a parental figure, giving guidance when people ask for it. She is there when she is needed. Her approach to management is the outgrowth of her simple motto, a leader is someone who helps others lead. How does a leader like Elaban create other leaders who can assume ownership and deliver on the mission of the organization themselves? We find answers in the three practices of the investor. The three practices of the investor. As we studied the unique way multipliers drive results, I found the practices remarkably similar to another world I know. This is a world driven by intellectual assets and investment multiples, where technology and business leaders develop other leaders in search of growth and returns and the creation of wealth. This is a world whose nerve center is just a mile from my house. On Sand Hill Road in Menlo Park, California, home to Silicon Valley's venture capital community, multi-million dollar investment decisions are made many times daily. Venture capital firms scour industries looking to invest in emerging technologies and young companies destined to become the industry leaders of the future. When a venture firm places its bet and invests a round of funding, it draws up a term sheet to govern the deal. Of particular interest to all parties is the specification of ownership levels. These ownership levels outline relative ownership for the business post-investment and dictate expectations for leadership and for accountability. Simply put, the term sheet lets the parties know who is in charge. Once ownership of the new company is established, the venture firm cuts a check and the investment of resources begins. This funding provides the financial resources to secure capital, intellectual property, and the human resources to fuel the business. But the value isn't limited to the financial resources. The real value often emerges from the insight and coaching the startup company receives from the senior partners at the venture firm. These investment partners are men and women who have grown businesses, incubated technology, and often managed very large companies themselves. They not only invest the capital of the fund, they invest their know-how into these nascent companies. They coach the CEO, they lend their Rolodex to assist with business development and sales, and they work with the management team to ensure financial targets can be met. After infusing capital and know-how, the venture partners look for expected returns. The returns in the marketplace may be years away, or may never materialize, but they watch for key milestones. The accountability is clear. If the company produces expected results, a second or third round of funding is likely. Otherwise, the company is left to make it on its own or die on the vine. Similarly, in their role as investors, multipliers define ownership up front and let other people know what is within their charge and what they are expected to build. They invest in the genius of others in a similar way. They teach and coach. They back people up, infusing the resources they need to be successful and to be independent. And multipliers complete the same investment cycle as they demand accountability from others. They understand that this accountability isn't ruthless. It is the draw that creates such extraordinary growth of intelligence and capability in others. We'll look at each of these three steps in turn. 1. Define ownership. 2. Invest resources. And 3. Hold people accountable. 1. Define ownership. Investors begin this cycle by establishing ownership up front. They see intelligence and capability in the people around them, and they put them in charge. Name the lead. When John Chambers, CEO of Cisco, hired his first vice president, Doug Allred, into the company, he gave the new VP of customer support control and made sure their respective roles were clear. He said, "Doug, when it comes to how we run this area of the company, you get 51% of the vote, and you're 100% responsible for the result. Keep me in the loop and consult with me as you go." Weeks later, when Doug was updating John on progress, John responded with, "I knew you'd surprise me on the upside." And it wasn't just Doug who received majority voting rights. John gives 51% of the vote to every member of his management in their respective areas of accountability. If your boss had told you that you owned 51% of the vote, how would you operate? Would you second-guess yourself and run all decisions by him? Or would you swing in the opposite direction and make decisions without consulting him? You probably would do neither. Most likely, you would consult your boss on important decisions to get a second opinion, and on the smaller stuff, you might be wise to ignore him or her as needed to get your job done. Giving someone 51% of the vote and full ownership creates certainty and builds confidence. It enables them to stop second-guessing and start getting second opinions. Clarifying the role that you will play as a leader actually gives people more ownership, not less. They then understand the nature of your involvement and when and how you will invest in their success. And most important, they understand that they hold the majority ownership position and that success or failure hinges on their efforts. Give ownership for the end goal. A management team is assembled for an off-site meeting to plan an important acquisition for their business. They kick off their work with a simple but powerful management exercise called the Big Picture. The team divides into 9 pairs, and each pair is given a 1-inch square from a photo of a famous modern painting. Each team is tasked with creating a reproduction and enlargement of its piece of the picture. In other words, each team is given a little piece of a bigger picture. The goal for the team is to bring all the enlargements together to form a unified replica of the original painting. The result should be a painting that is technically accurate and flows together seamlessly. The challenge is that no pair has seen the big picture. You can imagine what happens first. Each pair, energized by the challenge, studies their 1-inch square and begins to replicate it onto the large piece of paper in front of them. They dive into the task, make their sketches, and soon color erupts everywhere. As the time allotted for the first phase of work expires, they start turning their attention to their neighboring colleagues in the room. They begin to connect the pieces and notice that the painting isn't coming together very well. The lines don't match up. The colors don't blend. Their creation is looking like Frankenpainting. The session leader reminds them that their job is to optimize the whole, not their individual piece. They start to pay attention to the bigger picture. They rework their sections, focusing on integration and blending, although it is far too late to create a seamless product. The team delivers the big picture, but it remains a patchwork, only moderately resembling the original artwork. When people are given ownership for only a piece of something larger, they tend to optimize that portion, limiting their thinking to this immediate domain. When people are given ownership for the whole, they stretch their thinking and challenge themselves to go beyond their scope. When George Schneer, Intel division manager for the EEPROM memory chip, was building his management team, he staffed it with leaders from each of the functions in the business value chain: engineering and design, manufacturing, marketing, and sales. These leaders had come from other divisions inside Intel and were accustomed to being measured on the performance of their particular function. The sales leader was measured on sales, the marketing leader on market share, and the manufacturing leader on quality. But George did something different. He asked each member of his management team to assume the same measure of success: profit for the division. The team rallied to ensure the success of the whole division. They managed their individual function, but they readily contributed to solving the challenges in other parts of the business. They offered their full brain power to the team. Perhaps this is one reason why one member of the management team described the experience this way: "It was our business, and we were winning. There was an exciting pressure. I felt like the smartest guy on the planet." Stretch the role. We consistently find that multipliers get twice the capability from their people that diminishers do. And time after time, people tell us how multipliers not only got 100% from them, they got 120% or even more. Multipliers do get more than 100% of people's capability because people grow under the watch of a multiplier. One way that multipliers incite this growth is by asking people to stretch and do something they've never done before. Consider these 3 individuals. Eleanor Schaffner Mosch was a champion who needed a bigger cause. As the marketing director for the small IT, information technology, practice inside Booz Allen Hamilton in 1988, she ran basic demand generation programs. But when Booz decided to turn over the reins of the IT practice to a different partner who was intent on transforming the function, she suddenly found herself with a really big job. Within months, she was organizing a corporate-wide kickoff event to launch the vision for the IT practice. Next, she convened a forum of the top CIOs in the world. When she found herself sitting next to the CEO of Booz Allen Hamilton during one of these meetings, She confidently explained to him why the IT industry and the IT practice inside their firm was going to change the world. She said, "I wasn't afraid of anything or anyone. We knew what we were doing, and we felt like we could do anything." Mike Hagan was ready to take on the world, but he literally needed a passport. He worked as the director of sales operations for the billion-dollar U.S. sales division of a multinational company. His job was to make sure the sales force complied with company policy. When the president of the sales division wanted to globalize and grow the business, he tapped Mike to figure this out. One day, Mike was the policy police, writing tickets for sales administration offenders. The next day, he was architecting sales operations and policy for the entire global business. Initially, Mike protested, citing his inexperience with global operations. He confessed that he didn't even have a current passport. His protests were ignored. The president told him that he was smart and would surely figure this out. And he did. The experience was grueling but invigorating. Mike reflected, "I was given an opportunity to do something I had never done before. In fact, no one had ever done it." The job was huge, but Mike grew into it as predicted. Polly Sumner was a powerhouse waiting to be unleashed. When a new president joined Oracle, he noticed this channel sales manager's strategic savvy and drive and asked her to assume a vice president role, running alliances and strategic partnerships. In time, Polly was right in the middle of a very messy, high-stakes conflict. The management team could not agree on how quickly Oracle would release new versions of its database code to its applications partner and also competitor, SAP. Polly escalated the issue to her new boss, who responded with, "This is a complex issue and probably beyond the scope of your role, but you should be the one to lead the resolution." She went right to the people who could fix the problem. She found herself brokering a conversation between the billionaire founders and CEOs Hasno Plattner of SAP and Larry Ellison of Oracle in a meeting held at Larry's Japanese tea house. The issue was resolved to their mutual satisfaction, and Polly was a superstar. These three individuals all worked for the same boss, just in different settings. Who was the common denominator in this equation? It was Ray Lane, known for challenging his team and for exacting every ounce of their capability. When we asked people why they gave Ray so much, their answers revealed a consistent story. He asked them to do jobs that were far bigger than they were. He could spot smarts in others and gave people a chance to stretch well beyond their current capabilities. He gave them ownership, not at the level of their current capability, but always one and occasionally two levels up. When investors stretch the role, they stretch the person in it. This bigger role creates a vacuum that must be filled. 2. Invest resources. The moment investors establish an ownership position, they step in and begin investing. They protect their investment by infusing the knowledge and resources the person will need to successfully deliver on their accountability. Teach and coach. When Jay Choi at McKinsey inserts himself into the discussion with the project team, it isn't to show and tell what he knows. He grabs the pen so he can teach and coach. It is a simple distinction. Diminishers tell you what they know. Multipliers help you learn what you need to know. Jay is not only a business leader, but also an avid teacher who looks for the teachable moments when a team is spinning or has suffered a setback. In these moments, minds are most open and hungry. He contributes a relevant insight or asks just the right question to move the group forward. K.R. Sridhar, CEO of Bloom Energy, who has been described several times in previous chapters, is another masterful teacher. K.R.'s teaching doesn't occur in a classroom or in a corporate training center. It occurs in the face of very real problems. When the team is wrestling with a technical setback, K.R. engages, not with a solution, but with a thought-provoking question. He asks, "What do we know about what doesn't work?" And, "What assumptions led us to these outcomes?" And, "What risks do we face now that need to be mitigated?" His team pursues these questions in turn, unearthing their individual knowledge and building a collective body of intelligence. KR says, "You are teaching by helping your team solve real problems. Even if you know the solution, you don't offer it. If you do, you've lost the teaching moment. It has to be Socratic. You ask the question and tease out the answer. Although K.R. focuses on immediate problems, his investment in these teaching moments returns far more than just solutions to these problems. When leaders teach, they invest in their people's ability to solve and avoid problems in the future. It is one of the most powerful ways that multipliers build intelligence around them. Provide backup. When you think of investing intellectual capital in your direct reports, it is easy to assume that you are the one who needs to provide the capital. But this limits the investment options to what you know and what you have time and energy to invest. Michael Clark, the president of a $12 billion division of Flextronix, was facing market consolidation, and he urgently needed to develop an M&A strategy for his business. He had assigned the process of developing that strategy to his very capable vice president of strategy and new ventures, Becky Roller. She worked tirelessly across 9 different divisions, pulling together the best of their thinking for a joint 2-day strategy session and decision-making forum. But 10 days before the event, the entire process was interrupted when they found out an external consulting firm was leading a company-wide strategy initiative that would complicate their M&A strategy and take it in a different direction. Michael could have jumped in to give extra support, but he suspected he would be more disruptive than helpful. Instead, he asked Greg Keese, his vice president for business development, to work 2 in a box with Becky. He didn't reduce Becky's ownership. Becky was still fully responsible for the project. But given the latest complexities of this project, having 2 people's perspective and brain power would be essential. Greg joined Becky for key planning meetings, acted as a sounding board, and offered his support as they navigated the waters. At the completion of the strategy session, Michael praised Becky's leadership and thanked Greg for his backup on this critical project. Watching the management team in action, you could easily imagine the roles reversed next time, with Greg accountable and Becky in the box with him, providing backup. When leaders define clear ownership and invest in others, they have sown the seeds of success and earned the right to hold people accountable. 3. Hold people accountable. In working with hundreds of business executives, there is something I've noticed about the finest of these leaders. They all appear to have slanted tables in their offices. Sure, the desk they sit at, with their computer and phone, is perfectly flat, but their meeting table has a distinct slant to it. Perhaps you may not have noticed it, but surely you have seen how accountability for action rolls from their side of the table down to other people, and often to you. It may look flat to the unsuspecting eye, but if you placed a marble on one side, that marble would surely roll right off the opposite end. These leaders have a natural leaning to give accountability to others and keep it there. When their people push problems over to the manager's side of the table, by the end of the conversation, those problems slide right back to where they came from. The leader helps, offers suggestions, asks great questions, and may escalate a critical issue, but the accountability slides back and rests with their staff. Their tables slant in the direction of other people. One senior executive I worked for carried a small leather notebook with him in every meeting. Strangely, he never took meeting notes in it, but in every meeting, he was mentally present and fully engaged, listened intently, and offered carefully dispensed insight. During these meetings, I would furiously take notes, making careful notation of my action items. Others did the same. On rare occasions, I would see him write a single note in his book. These occasions were reserved for when he alone was accountable for an action. This was the slanted desk in action. This leader knew how to keep the accountability with his people. He was fully engaged, but he did not take over. And because he assumed accountability with careful restraint, when he wrote an action down in his little leather book, you could be sure it would be done by the next day. Give it back. Investors get involved in other people's work, but they continually give back leadership and accountability. John Wookey is an executive vice president of development at SAP, a veteran of the application